This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio. Sitting in for Libby, here is Tasha Kiridan.
Good afternoon to you. Happy slushy Wednesday if you're here in the GTA. But wherever you are, we're thrilled to have you aboard and happy to be in the chair here. So much going on. We'll get to all of it in the next hour, starting with our medical record panel. We're going to talk about cheaper obesity medications on the horizon. Health Canada is reviewing generic versions of 9 obesity drugs, including OOO, Ozempic, and Wegovy. That could cut the cost of those drugs in half. We're also going to discuss the so-called off-target benefits that vaccines can give to the older population. Reductions in cardiovascular risk, decline in dementia. Would this make you perhaps more apt or inclined to get a vaccine? Plus, it's Glaucoma Awareness Month. We're going to unpack the signs and also the possible treatments that exist for this disease. Then at 12:30, we're going to talk about that big story that's we're all staying tuned to, which is the fallout from the developments in Venezuela now affecting Greenland. We're going to welcome Christian Luprecht from the Royal Military College and Robert Christian Thompson, a professor, to discuss Greenland and also Canada in light of those events and what might come next for that island and for our country as well. And finally, we're going to discuss a horrific story of elder abuse that raises really serious questions about safety in long-term care homes. I'll have two lawyers on, Melissa Miller and Jane Medis, who act for the elderly in many cases similar to this, to discuss the implications of that case. And as always, we want you to be part of the conversation. So please send us a text at 1-866-740-4740. My pleasure to read them on the air. All that and more coming up on Fight Back.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
All right, time to talk all things healthcare with Dr. Alisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing primary care here in Toronto, Dr. Amol Verma, staff physician in general internal medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, and Dr. Aaron Schimmer, the director of research at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, as well as a staff physician and senior scientist. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, good to be here.
Hi.
All right, so let's kick this off with what's perhaps a New Year's resolution for a lot of people, losing that weight. And of course, we know there are many drugs on the market that currently can help people achieve that goal. I mentioned a couple, Ozempic, Wegovy. There's, I think, 9 different forms of weight loss, semaglutide-based medications out there. And now we've learned that those 9 medications are going to be coming in generic form to Canadians sometime in the future. So, Dr. Naiman, I'm going to start with you. Why is this happening now? Why is Health Canada suddenly reviewing these generic versions?
So, for some reason, Novo Nordisk did not extend or fill in the required information to extend the patent for semaglutide within Canada and only in Canada. So their patent lapsed as of the end of December. So that allows the drug to go and become generic. And now generic companies can now go and provide an application to Health Canada to get their drug approved so that semaglutide would be available in a generic form.
And semaglutide, of course, as I said, is the basis for these prescription medications, these that were developed by drug companies. Dr. Verma, this opens the door to a cheaper version of this. How much of a price differential is this going to make for potential patients and, I guess, existing patients, too?
Yeah, it's a bit tough to say right now exactly how much the cost savings will be. So these are sort of some generic estimates, but the current cost that people pay for a version, depending on what specific pill they're using of semaglutide, could range from anywhere from $200 to $400 a month. And there are some other similar versions of this medication or other similar types of medications, like the other brand name in this space is called Mounjaro. That could be even more expensive, as much as $600 a month for some formulations. The cost savings that we expect might be to get it down to even half that price. So, you know, savings of a couple hundred dollars a month for people, which is a really meaningful cost saving. So it depends a little bit on the specific preparations and how much, you know, once these generic, like which generic versions are approved and how they release them. So still a bit TBD, but we're expecting there to be really substantial cost savings.
So obviously this would make this drug more attractive or available to a lot of people, especially I'm thinking folks who do not have insurance. Dr. Schimmer, do you foresee an uptick in people interested in this drug? And are there any dangers with it? I'm just wondering if it becomes really cheap as, you know, having a coffee a day kind of thing at your local Starbucks. Are people just going to say, oh, I'll try it? Are there any restrictions? Like, what could this lead to people maybe taking the drug that shouldn't? I'm just wondering.
So I think it's important to recognize that this remains a prescription medication. So this is not a drug that you can walk into your pharmacy, buy over the counter, and decide whether or not you want to take it. It's got to be administered through a prescription and monitoring by your physician. So, you know, there will likely be some additional uptake because for people for whom it was previously a financial barrier, and the cost lowering to a half or a third may make the drug feasible. But one must hope that these are individuals who really needed to have the drug because, of course, it is being prescribed by the physician. The more interesting question is, will there be a large uptake of cross-border shoppers coming in from the United States who want to access the significantly lower drug supplies by just driving maybe what's as little as half an hour north of the border? That will be exceptionally interesting.
Yeah, that I was going to get to that, too, because obviously if these drugs are made in Canada, it could be a boon for the drug makers, the generic drug makers, who would be able to sell these to whoever they wanted, not just presumably Canadian consumers. Is this drug available? You know, you said it's prescription only. Is it available by mail? Is there like a huge potential global market for this, these generics now that could come from Canada? Dr. Naiman, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and if I could just make another comment in terms of with the cost of the drug going to be reduced, you're going to be seeing many people going and accessing the drug. And as I've mentioned before on many episodes, I have patients who will come to me and say that they want the drug and they do not meet the criteria. Mm-hmm. But everybody seems now again to want to lose another 10, 15 pounds, and they know friends who are on it, and they come and they harass me or really are very aggressive in trying to get the prescription. I've also had patients who after the fact will come in and say to me, well, I've gone to an online provider and I've been able to access the drug. And then they come and tell me that either they're taking it or that something happened, but it's actually not that difficult to get it through online providers. And I don't know, with me being home during the holidays, there were many commercials for now online providers who are providing weight loss drugs. And you basically fill in a form online to determine whether or not you qualify. And in that case, usually the prescription is actually shipped to your house. And I think one patient told me about this because she was so upset because the medication has to be refrigerated, and it came during the summer on a hot day and was left outside her house, and she was quite upset. So yes, there will be an expansion of the drug, and unfortunately, there's many people who will be able to access it who don't meet the criteria, and unfortunately, all of the hard work that we've done over many years in terms of body issues, I feel, has been lost because everybody wants to be thin. And you will see that there will be many people from outside of the country who will be getting the drug shipped to them internationally and through the United States.
Yeah, this is making a culture shift. You know, Ozempic has sort of entered the lexicon as like, yeah, like you said, oh, everyone knows somebody who's on it. Celebrities are on it in droves, dropping a lot of weight in some cases, almost unrecognizable. You know, there's the Ozempic face syndrome where you lose too much weight fast and suddenly you look older. I mean, all these things that we never were a thing before now are. How much is this changing the culture around weight Dr. Verma. And, you know, when you see patients, is this something now that, you know, the, Dr. Naiman said, you know, weight issues are now becoming, you could solve it with a pill or an injection, as opposed to something that maybe we should be more accepting of different weights? Is the culture significantly changing in, the, in your patients? Do you see that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the culture around weight has been, this is a very long-standing, obviously, issue around weight, where, you know, body image issues have been, you know, long-standing. These drugs are not the first drugs to support weight loss. We've had weight loss drugs for, you know, many years, and there are weight loss clinics that prescribe all different kinds of drugs. These just happen to be some of the best tolerated and the most effective drugs for weight loss that we've ever had. So I do think you're right, Tasha, that there has been a change in the culture, that this has entered the lexicon in a way that most other treatments or therapies perhaps have not. I do think that's, you know, there's pros and cons of that, obviously, like the fact we have a real obesity problem. And so, you know, these are very useful, very helpful medications for a certain set of the population, especially those people with diabetes, but also those who are just overweight for other reasons. And so, you know, I think that good comes with a little bit of the bad, which is that sort of celebrification and you know, the cosmetic aspects of this, which I honestly think are less of a concern. One of the challenges, though, and Dr. Naiman sort of spoke to this a little bit, there was a time when supply of these drugs was a real challenge. And so inappropriate use of these drugs for off-label indications like weight loss when you don't need it actually made it harder for people with very legitimate medical need to get these drugs. And that is something I do worry a little bit about, but getting more generic supply actually helps reduce that problem as well, because there'll just be better access to these drugs.
Yeah, Dr. Shimmer, remind us how these drugs work, how semaglutides work, and how it's different from previous weight loss medications.
So these work through different mechanisms than previous weight loss medications or even diabetic medications. They mimic a naturally occurring gut hormone. And what the semaglutide or Ozempic does is it stimulates the pancreas to produce more insulin. It delays the emptying of the stomach. And as a result of delaying the emptying, you feel more full, and it has direct actions on the brain, so one does not feel as hungry. And so you combine all of this, you get blood sugar control through insulin, but importantly, in relative to the discussion we're having on weight loss, you simply don't feel like eating as much. And it works then through a mechanism that's completely different than all of our other diabetic or weight loss medications. And, you know, it seems that each month or each week, even, one's discovering a new mechanism of action or new role for this gut hormone semaglutide or GLP-1 agonist. So it's really an exciting area. And I got to tell you, there is a real Canadian success story behind all of this. This work was a result of the pioneering research of Dr. Dan Drucker, a very accomplished Toronto clinician, scientist, and endocrinologist.
Well, that's interesting too. I had not heard that before. So nice to know there's a Canadian connection to this this drug, which has brought a lot of relief to a lot of people who do need it. Like to know, actually, if you're listening right now, if you are a consumer of any of these semaglutide based targeting medications for weight loss, or for if you're a diabetic, 1-866-740-4740 is the number to text. What's your experience? Are you happy about this new generic news? And if you're not on the medication, would this generic now be something you might pester your physician, Dr. Naiman, to get because you want to try it? And I want to ask you, Dr. Naiman, you said that, you know, people are demanding it. Do they know the risks, though? Because there are risks to this, too. And what are they?
To be honest, I don't think people fully understand what the risks of the medication are. I think people just see celebrities and their friends have lost a lot of weight and they also want to lose a lot of weight. And some of it relates to they think that they're just, you know, I just need to lose 10 pounds and then I'm going to come off of the drug. But that's not how these drugs work. They increase a gut hormone, and that gut hormone makes you feel full and also sends signals to your brain. And so once you stop the medication, you're going to gain back the weight. And even in the studies, in the trials that go out 2 years for weight loss, people, while still on the drug, will still gain weight by the end of the 2 years. So I don't think people understand that. Now, everybody thinks it works. It doesn't work for everyone. Some people are somewhat, like, respond in they only lose a little bit of weight. Some people are super responders and they lose a lot of weight. And then there's the people in the middle. And a lot of people actually don't tolerate the drug. There's a lot of abdominal pain. There's a lot of nausea. Constipation is a big issue. And many people will actually have to stop the drug because of that. Some people will actually complain of something that they describe as sulfur burps, where they'll burp up sulfur and it's so debilitating and so upsetting, this taste, that I've had a couple of patients stop it for that. And then we don't know what the long-term impacts of the drug is. There's some concern and issue in terms of muscle mass, that a loss in muscle mass that's associated with it. And I know there's many drug trials now and lots of drugs that are in the pipeline. And that's one of the issues that they're trying to work on, is that there could be, within this peptide concoction that exists, that there could be medications that can help or drugs that help to stop the amount of muscle loss that happens as a part of your total weight loss. And that becomes a big issue, especially as people get older and we understand the importance of maintaining your muscle mass and your risk of falls and all, and fragility fractures and everything that happens along the lines. There's also an associated eye condition where people who are on the drug, that there's an increased risk of becoming blind, and that's also associated with people who are diabetic. So that's something else that people need to be aware of. So we'll see what will happen. There's many drugs that are currently undergoing trial, and you'll see that this whole market will explode, and it will become that pretty much all of us eventually will be on it, because there will be an indication for us all to be taking it. But I think people do need to be cautious and need to have the right indication and the reason for why they're taking the drug.
All right. Some very, very sobering thoughts here and important considerations, because as we've said, it's become almost a celebrity or a celebrification of these drugs that is encouraging so many people to think it's their panacea. But you're right. When you go off them, I do know personally of people who are in this situation, who've had taken them, gone off them, and immediately back to eating because their system is no longer, their appetite is no longer suppressed. And it was, it's quite distressing. If people have to stay on a drug for a very long time, especially when we don't know all the implications. I want to move on to another story, which is very important at this time of year. And I think very important in the climate we're in, which is vaccines and the side benefits, the so-called, off-label, but surprising benefits that vaccines can have on other conditions for which they actually were never intended. We live in a very vaccine-averse culture in some ways. Ever since the pandemic, there's been an increase in people who don't want to take vaccines and they're skeptical. But studies have shown that apparently vaccines against things like shingles and the flu can have benefits, especially for older adults, on conditions like cardiovascular risk and dementia. So I want to explore that and see what you think of this research and if it's a way maybe to encourage people to get vaccinated. Dr. Verma, let me start with you. Were you aware of these side benefits, so to speak, for these vaccines? Is this something that you've come across before, or was it news to you?
Yeah, so this is an area of work that's been pretty well known, I think, over going back 5, 10, even longer number of years, about sort of the various benefits of vaccines. What I think is really interesting when we think about this kind of observation is most of these studies are not causal studies. They're looking at people who got vaccines compared to people who didn't get vaccines and seeing differences. And a lot of reasons might suggest why someone would get a vaccine versus not get a vaccine might be related to people who are more health conscious or people who are more likely to have a doctor or relate to their socioeconomic status. So there's a lot of what we call scientifically confounding in these studies. And so then we have to ask, okay, well, is there a good biological plausibility, a good way to understand how these vaccines might lead to these other benefits? And I would say that the evidence base for a certain kind of benefit is actually quite robust from that causal perspective. And that's related to cardiovascular outcomes in particular. And actually, we've had more recently some randomized studies where patients were randomly allocated to receiving a vaccine or not, especially for the latest RSV vaccines, where we were able to then see benefits in cardiovascular outcomes. So reduced risk of hospital visits for cardiac conditions, for things like heart attacks and heart failure and other things like that. And so I think for your respiratory vaccines like influenza and RSV, other kinds of respiratory illnesses, the fact that those vaccines prevent heart complications is now quite well established. And the biological plausibility for that is that when you have an infection like flu, RSV, they put a lot of strain on your system. And we know that they're associated with increased risk of heart failure, of destabilizing your heart disease. So preventing those infections or making those infections less severe leads to better outcomes, and you're less likely to end up in hospital with a heart problem. So I think that's a very clear association that we can say is really strong. Some of the other ones are interesting, but probably more kind of we still need to think about. That would be things like whether the herpes zoster shingles vaccine can reduce your risk of dementia. There's a good plausible explanation for that, again, where the virus, the zoster virus, can get into your brain and it can infect the blood vessels in the brain. So preventing that and reducing inflammation and strokes in the brain could prevent dementia in theory. But that evidence is a little more, I would say, speculative, whereas the heart benefits are pretty well established now.
Yeah, that shingles vaccine research dates from 2013, when the first shingles vaccine was available. It was available to people who had not yet turned 80 years old. And what was seen was that over 7 years, dementia rates in participants who had been eligible for vaccination declined by 20%, even though only half of them had actually received the vaccine, compared to a group of people who had just missed the cutoff date for the vaccine. So the theory was there's no reason for people being born 1 week before the date to be different from those born a few days later, apart from the vaccine. That was the conclusion. But as you said, there are, of course, other variables in these studies. Dr. Naiman, you know, when people come to you and say or discuss the flu shot as a patient, for example, is this something that you mention to them if they are perhaps hesitant or dismissive of the flu shot? Is it a benefit that maybe could encourage more people to get a shot that can reduce their risk of disease, especially this time of year?
So in the past, I actually haven't mentioned that there would be a potential downstream benefit of maybe reducing your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. And you are right, within the climate that we exist now, for people who are on the fence and maybe don't want to get it, then it should be something that I should be mentioning. And I guess will become part of my spiel for what I tell people in terms of getting vaccines in the limited amount of time. Usually I talk in terms of, you know, avoiding hospitalization, or if you're somebody who's younger and who's working, the amount of time that you might miss from being off work and not feeling well, or if you have elderly parents in your life and they need to get it so that you're not passing it on. But this is definitely something that should be included in terms of mentioning that there are other effects of health benefits of getting vaccination.
And Dr. Schibber, I'm assuming that, you know, more research will be done on this. How could this research, as director of research, you direct cancer research, but how would a research protocol for something like this be done in the future to see if really to tease out those other elements that could maybe affect the outcome of the trials here? What could be done?
So this is actually a really hot area of scientific research and biology, and it relates to the concept of inflammation. And we're now starting to understand the impacts of inflammatory signals in the body. And so the reason these vaccines, of course, are working to protect against heart disease, stroke, and probably even dementia is because they prevent infection with the actual virus. And that virus, if you're infected with it, results in inflammation in the body. And the inflammation then ultimately has a number of downstream consequences. It is triggering damage to the blood vessels that can ultimately lead to heart attacks, strokes, and I think probably also relates to the issues of dementia. But issues around inflammation, which were, again, a very hot area of research, influence cancer research as well. You know, believe it or not, we now think that a lot of cancer therapies are causing inflammation in the cancer tumor. And by causing inflammation, they actually increase the ability of the body's immune system to attack and destroy cancer. So this broadly, again, relates to a concept and study in the area of inflammation, which is spanning across areas of biology and disease sites, and is one of the really hot areas.
That is really fascinating. In the time I have left, though, I do want to move to one last thing we talked about earlier, which is that this is Glaucoma Awareness Month. Glaucoma, I know, it's not the inflammation of the eye, but it's the buildup of pressure in the eye that damages the optic nerve, and it can come on with no symptoms in the early stages. I understand, Dr. Verma, but its consequences can be really disastrous for vision. What should people be aware of this month about the signs of glaucoma, and what should they do if they're concerned that they may be developing this disease?
Yeah, there are two kinds of glaucoma. There's an acute kind of glaucoma, which is acutely painful, and like it's not a subtle thing. Like you will know, and people, you know, seek emergency care for that when it happens. Severe pain and loss of vision in one of their eyes. But the kind of glaucoma that you're talking about, which we call open angle glaucoma, is more subtle. And it presents really with a subtle loss, especially of peripheral vision. And it's from, as you say, a buildup of pressure in the eyes. And it does require just proper eye exams to try to catch it early. So certainly if people are worried that they're losing vision, especially peripheral vision, they should go get a proper eye exam. It can be from an optometrist or an ophthalmologist where they will check the pressures in the eye, but they also do other things. They look under the microscope and look at different aspects of the angles in the eye and things like that. But perhaps it's better, especially with a condition like glaucoma, to not be waiting for that peripheral vision. And this is where there are recommendations that people seek an eye exam periodically as per their risk. So if you're an otherwise healthy person, you know, above the age of 40, I think it's recommended that you get an eye exam once and then thereafter as per the recommendation of your eye doctor. And as you age, maybe a little bit more frequently every few years. And then certainly if you have other risk factors. So if you have things like diabetes, high blood pressure or very low blood pressure indeed, or a family history of glaucoma, or if you're very nearsighted, some of those things can increase your risk of having glaucoma. And so you should just be getting your eyes checked more frequently.
All right. Well, we're going to end it there. And that is good advice in this Glaucoma Awareness Month. Maybe if you don't have any serious symptoms, go get your eyes checked, get that annual eye vision checkup that we all should get anyway. Put that in your calendar, a good way to start the new year. I want to thank all three of our medical record panelists, Dr. Alisa Naiman, Dr. Amal Verma, and Dr. Aaron Schimmer, for sharing their time with us today. And for our next segment, after this break, we're going to turn to, well, yes, geopolitics and just what is happening with Greenland and Donald Trump's interest in that place. What could that mean not only for Greenland, but also potentially for Canada? We'll delve into that in a moment on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Well, how green is my valley? Now, how green is my land? Green is the color of the day, it seems, because Donald Trump has been fixated on Greenland. That's right. An island that we really probably have not talked about much in the news for decades. It's really not been a hot spot. There's been, you know, occasional reasons to discuss it, but never in this context, as the hotspot of geopolitics right now, with Donald Trump, president of the U.S., saying that he wants to acquire Greenland, either buy it or through military force, because in his words, it's full of Chinese and Russian ships all over the place, and the U.S. needs it for security reasons. What is the truth around all this interest by the U.S.? How real is it? And what implications does it have for other countries, including our own, that are also necessary for U.S. security. To unpack all this, we're joined now by Christian Luprecht, professor at the Royal Military College and Queen's University, and Robert Christian Thompson, associate professor, Department of Culture and Communication at Aalborg University in Denmark, who researches both Canada and Greenland. Welcome to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much.
All right. So, Professor Thompson, I'll start with you. What is the attraction of Greenland for the U.S.? I mean, Donald Trump talks about it in terms of security, but is that the only reason he's interested in it?
Well, that depends on how you define security, of course. But Trump's argument is that the U.S. needs Greenland to counter the Russian and Chinese threat in the Arctic. So basically dusting off the old Monroe Doctrine that there be no adversary power interference in the U.S. interest sphere, right? So this has to do with the fact that Arctic land and sea ice is receding due to climate change, as we all know. The Arctic is becoming, as a consequence, more accessible. New sea lanes for shipping, but also potentially submarines, warships that can navigate here more easily. Potentially problematic, especially if you know, Russian submarines carry nuclear weapons and the like. So in addition to that, of course, there's the receding ice caps and sea ice also means access to oil, gas, and minerals. So we're talking now about a different kind, perhaps, of resource security that Trump might be interested in also, including rare earth elements, which we need for computers, for electric cars, sophisticated weapon system, etc. And rare earth elements, which China currently holds almost a monopoly on. If you look at a geological map of Greenland, it shows clearly, I think, the abundance of natural resources that are being made accessible now by the melting land and sea ice. So I think that's probably something that interests the Americans, the Trump administration in particular. And then there's political symbolism, of course. You know, flexing his muscles in the international environment will portray Trump as a powerful president and stoke American nationalism, and that speaks to his advantage, at least domestically. But of course, importantly, the U.S. does not actually need ownership of Greenland for these kinds of security. Since the 1951 defense agreement between the U.S. and Danish governments, and since 2004 also the Greenland local government, the U.S. will assist, that's the agreement, will assist Danish defense of Greenland. And it's Article 5 is very clear about this. The U.S. has complete access to all of Greenland for almost any kind of motive. You know, the Americans just have to ask politely, and I think even for Donald Trump that would be possible. So the Americans get the Thule Air Base, rather the Bitterfix Space Base today, and many other military bases, and there used to be many more American military bases in Greenland, but most of them were actually shut down by the U.S. government after the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, you mentioned Donald Trump could just ask politely, and there is a long history, in fact, dating back to, as you said, the 1950s, earlier, to basically keep, you know, the Nazi threat at bay and the interest in Greenland, and the U.S. has a base in Greenland currently. So, Christian, why would Donald Trump not ask politely? Is it just a style thing for him, or is there other reasons?
Well, for one thing, Donald Trump is a politician who actually says, he does what he says, which makes him sort of very different, which is why we should all be concerned. But look, this is in keeping with 250 years of U.S. policy in the hemisphere, going back to the Revolutionary War and its effective invasion through Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu and Montreal up to Quebec. That the U.S. will act unilaterally in the hemisphere. And in the case of Donald Trump, it abandons the 75-year precedent that U.S. action should be to the joint benefit of allies and the U.S. I think he sees the world in more zero-sum terms. So if it's to the detriment of allies, so be it. I do think there's also some posturing here. Donald Trump is showing that the U.S. holds most of the cards in these negotiations, and that allies will do essentially as he asks. But, you know, we just got the Paris Agreement. There's also some indication that negotiations with the U.S., not just with the Trump administration, I mean, the U.S. has always been unilateral, especially in the hemisphere, that there are prospects for negotiation and for successful negotiation. But certainly certainly Donald Trump is driving a very hard bargain, and that bargain is intended to ensure that the U.S. remains the dominant superpower, and you know, will, whether it's for security reasons, economic reasons, or simply geopolitically, that he says, you know, we've had the Louisiana purchase, the Alaska purchase, you know, this will be the Greenland purchase in his view.
Right. And he is talking about purchase. He himself has said that he wants to buy Greenland as opposed to invade it, but doesn't rule out the use of military force. So, Professor Thompson, what might such an offer, such a deal look like? Professor Thompson, I'm not sure if we've lost you.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. If you're still there, Professor Thompson, I'm wondering, what kind of deal might Donald Trump try to strike? What would be, you know, in his view, attractive to buy Greenland? How would he do that?
Well, first of all, it's not possible. you cannot buy Greenland. Perhaps you can persuade Greenlanders by investments that this would be the right way to go, and that is indeed a possibility. You know, with the Greenland Self-Government Act from 2009, Greenlanders were recognized in the act, by the Danish Parliament, and were recognized in the act as a people with the right to complete political self-determination, which means that if the Greenlanders decide tomorrow that they want to establish Greenland as an independent state, they can actually do that as long as there's a majority that votes for it. So if in that case, of course, in that case of Greenland independence, the situation is completely different. And in that case, we might be talking about a purchase of sorts, but Trump would have to make Americans would have to make the Greenlanders a very good offer in terms of, or in the form of investments, etc., and probably not in the form of sovereignty association, as has been suggested, because the Greenlanders are very keen not to let go of those hard-won rights of self-determination.
Right. In fact,
to answer your question more specifically, perhaps it would be in the form of investments in natural resource extraction.
Okay, but what if it's not that? Well, I'll posit something to you. What if there's 56,000 people in Greenland? What if Donald Trump said to them, okay, you got to have a referendum. I will give $1 million to every man, woman, and child in Greenland. That's $56 billion, probably cheaper than invasion, maybe cheaper than investment, but it'll go directly to you. No questions asked, as long as you sign on to be part of the United States as a protectorate or whatever it would be. How would that go? Do you think he might say, let's make a deal and make it personal so that he would win that referendum? Because as you point out, he'd have to have a referendum to take it without force. I put it to either of you. Maybe Christian, do you want to weigh in on that?
I mean, clearly Donald Trump is looking at U.S. interests and furthering, in particular, U.S. prosperity. And so this is not sort of, I think, an unreasonable proposition, at least sort of in the way that he's looking at the universe here. The problem is, I think, any course of action by the Trump administration, whether it's military invasion or what you just proposed, would effectively be the end of NATO, because you can have the largest guarantor of NATO, and the Danish prime minister has come out and said as much. It's a question of sort of what cost is the Trump administration willing to incur for the benefits that it believes that it can glean. But it's also a reminder to all of us that Canada, you know, the Danes have been a bit better at this than Canada, investing in instruments of statecraft. Trump has the cards because we've not invested. And so now we're standing here and watching while the U.S. shapes the world, and we're making up for many of the shortcomings of the last 25 years.
All right. And those shortcomings now, it's a very short horizon to kind of fix them. I'm wondering what implications this has for Canada, Professor Thompson, as we watch the drama around Greenland unfold.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure there won't be any immediate impacts or implications, but in the long term, definitely. I think as middle powers with an interest in the Arctic, Canada and Denmark share a lot of values in regard to international relations and rules-based politics. And if that goes down the drain, of course, it will have a very serious effect also on Canada and Canada's relations with the U.S. I mean, if the Trump administration is indeed successful in taking away territory from a fellow ally in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization without any immediate consequences. I mean, who's to prevent that administration from pursuing Trump's dream of a 51st state of America, which lies north of the 49th parallel, right? International law, non-intervention, non-violation of state sovereignty, the prohibition on the use of force, etc., of course, protects Canada. But if we're, you know, polemic about it, it was also supposed to protect Venezuela recently and didn't. So I think Canada needs strong friends outside of North America, and it should probably look to across the Atlantic Ocean to the EU and like-minded states.
Yeah, and we know, last question to you, Christian Luprecht. We know that one of the issues here is China. The issue in Venezuela was China's influence that Trump wants to counter. Same with Greenland. He says China's too present in the area. Mark Carney is heading out to China. We just found out. I mean, the trip was organized earlier, but he's chatting out to China next week to meet Xi Jinping. Interesting timing. What would your advice to him be in light of these recent developments and the clear agenda that Trump has in countering China? How close should we be getting to that power?
Well, I think we have to avoid irritating the Trump administration. And for instance, not purchasing the F-35 would be a major irritant. I think also getting too close to Europe would be a major irritant. So I think there's a balancing strategy that the prime minister is pursuing here. And the Trump administration is concerned about China per se. It's concerned about certain actions, the way China is manipulating the international system, the trade system, and the way China is trying to play in America's backyard. And I think whether it's Venezuela or Greenland, the Trump administration is signaling it will not tolerate China owning critical natural resources in America's backyard, that those resources America regards as its resources. And it also will not tolerate, as my colleague pointed out, adversarial military activity in its backyard. But for Canada, this is an existential moment. I mean, the end, NATO is Canada's most important multilateral organization. Canada would have significantly less leverage internationally. Canada would be much more isolated, much more dependent on the United States. And Canada is already facing a significant decline in living standards as a result of the tariffs. So I think Trump also has a strategy of how he basically makes Canada much more dependent on the United States. And we can only counter that by aggressively engaging in trade and in particular hydrocarbon export strategies with China. Look, I mean, there's lots of opportunity for exporting liquid natural gas to China, for instance. It would be a great contribution also in terms of mitigating climate change. So I think there's many areas where we can find common ground that would not necessarily irritate the Trump administration and could be good for the world as a whole if we're smart about our engagement, not just with Europe, but with China.
Well, let's hope that we are exactly that. And I want to thank both of you for sharing your thoughts on this critical issue today. Christian Luprecht of the Royal Military College and Robert Christian Thompson, Professor, Department of Culture and Communication at Aalborg University in Denmark. Thank you so much for joining us. When we come back after this short break, we're going to take a look at a story closer to home that is really horrific. It's the only word I can use for it. It's a horrible story of sexual abuse in a nursing home that we're going to discuss with two lawyers. What could be done? What could have been done to prevent this? And what can we do to ensure that this sort of thing never happens again? That's next on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back to the show. This is going to be a difficult segment to do because the case that it involves is just so terrible. It was chronicled in the Toronto Star today. It's a terrible story of sexual abuse at a nursing home here that involved a 90-year-old woman who was confined to her bed. She had dementia, but was still aware of things happening in her immediate vicinity. And she was repeatedly sexually assaulted by a care worker, despite her daughter's suspicions that something was wrong, and also the fact the individual involved was supposed to himself be under supervision. He still had access to her unsupervised. This terrible, these assaults happened. How could this happen is the question we're asking, and how can we ensure it never happens again? We're joined now to discuss this by Melissa Miller, partner at Howie Sachs and Henry LLP, an advocate for the elderly, as well as Jane Midas, staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly, ACE. Welcome to you both.
Hi, good afternoon.
All right. Ms. Miller, I'll start with you. I read this story. I was just sick reading this story. And first of all, I'm wondering how, if you've ever seen anything like this before, is this a common, is sexual assault in nursing homes, how bad is this? Because it's not something that first springs to mind when you think of assault, but it obviously does happen. How big a problem is sexual assault and this case like it?
Unfortunately, I hear about it and see it all the time. Oh. I have more than a dozen ongoing cases involving resident on resident sexual abuse and sometimes even staff on resident sexual abuse. It's actually becoming a bit of a subspecialty, unfortunately, in my practice.
Now, this is shocking, but what's more shocking in this case was that there was some video footage, but the footage apparently wasn't, the daughters of this woman wanted to access it. They were told by the home they could not. It was also not kept for more than 30 days. It was seemed really inadequate ways of preventing this. Ms. Midas, I want to ask you, what can families do to try and prevent this kind of abuse happening? And how shocked were you by the fact that even though they had some surveillance, it didn't make a difference in this case?
Yeah, it's not uncommon for homes to prevent people from getting access to these tapes in the hall. And what I want to say is that if you are aware of them, you should make a request immediately under the privacy legislation to get access so that they don't get rid of them, because you do actually have access to them if it has to do with yourself or your resident in the home. This is not uncommon, as Melissa said. We see this fairly often. I've actually had cases where families have put in cameras in the room where they've been a live camera and seen the incident happening live and having to call the home. And so it's something that, people really need to be aware of. I think that what's really shocking in this case appears to be that this was a known issue and that the home did nothing about it. Or it was inadequate. And frankly, so was the ministry's response to the issues that were going on here.
Yeah, this was at the Norfinch Nursing Home in North York, which is operated by Siena Senior Living. And the individual was Wei Chen, who actually I understand here was a resident at the home. What happened was the victim was initially there with her husband, who then passed away and was left alone in the home and was repeatedly assaulted by this individual, Wei Chan. Even though he was confined to a wheelchair as well, he had apparently psychological issues from a young age. But again, he was known to be, like you said, there was known to have issues of sexual assault allegations by other patients as well. Melissa, you said that this is a common thing, but you would think that when a home is aware that there's a risk, they would take all methods to prevent this from happening. Obviously, that didn't happen here.
Yeah, and one thing I note when I was reading about this is that he was supposed to have one-to-one level care. And my first reaction to reading about what happened was, well, if he had one-to-one care, how could this have happened? So that means that they weren't actually following through on their own requirement to have one-to-one care for him, which, by the way, is very rare. And I know Jane can attest to this. It's highly unusual.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer is produced by Zeev Hadi with technical...
Sorry. Continue, please. That was just an accidental interruption.
I was just saying that it's highly unusual for someone to even get one-to-one level of funding from the ministry, and for that not to be used by the home is extremely concerning.
Right. And it is something also that, Jane, I think a lot of families are listening to this and thinking, the guilt that these two daughters felt about putting their mother in that home and subjecting her to this is something they will live with forever. But they are angry. They are angry also at the response that the ministry and the justice system had to this in this situation. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. It's a very complex issue, and certainly the ministry response was to make some orders, but the home didn't follow through on what they should have done when they initially became aware of situations. They weren't reporting to the ministry. They didn't report to the police, according to the information. It was the family that reported to the police, and it's mandatory reporting to the police. One of the issues that we have in the system is that long-term care homes are healthcare. And so the individual who's the perpetrator is entitled to healthcare in our system, you know, even though they're not a good person. But we don't have a proper system where someone like this can go. So they end up in a general population with something like, you know, one-to-one sometimes. But, you know, the one-to-one, what we find is people don't show up for their shift, or they go on break and nobody takes over. And so it's not uncommon for these sort of things to happen, even though they're supposed to be one-on-one for someone. You know, we certainly are seeing, you know, a really big boom in people putting cameras into their loved ones' rooms, and that there's issues around that, as well as, you know, with respect to privacy of the individual who lives in the home, and, you know, whether they want it there, if they're competent or not. But, you know, I think that homes are really needing to do better, but the ministry needs to be doing things like, in this case, I think that their charges should have been laid against the home. There was a repeated pattern, and why were they not, you know, why are the homes not being prosecuted? And it's not just this home. There are many where these sort of things should be getting prosecuted. And maybe if that was happening and they were properly held to account, maybe they would take these things more seriously. But there's really, you know, it's such a slap on the hand that, you know, the homes, they can still fill the beds. They don't seem to take it seriously, which is very sad.
Go ahead. I was going to say there's a $4 million civil lawsuit here, Melissa. Is that a deterrent?
Yeah, I was just going to say it. I mean, this is where some accountability and justice can come in. And that's my role in these situations, is to bring a civil suit. And, you know, while there would be damages awarded, you know, you can claim for punitive damages. And in the absence of adjacent charges from the ministry, you might be successful if you can prove that there's an ongoing pattern. But I mean, all of this is a little too late, right? And I mean, what you're left with is this impact on the family, the resident. And one thing I'll say here is, one of the things I hear from families a lot is that the victims in these cases often exhibit very subtle changes in their behavior after having gone through this kind of abuse. If they have dementia or Alzheimer's, and they might not be able to recall or tell the story in the way that you or I would if something like this happened, they might not even have a memory of it in a narrative fashion, but their nervous system certainly remembers a violation. And now all of a sudden they're scared in their own home and they don't remember why. And they're scared of strangers and they're scared of anyone that's not their family. And maybe they become aggressive. Maybe they become withdrawn. Maybe they become extremely sad all of a sudden. Those are things to look out for in your family members if you have a loved one in a home that can't tell you what happened. And then, of course, having the camera. But I mean, all of a prevention, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, they say, right? And I mean, that's where we have to put the focus. Right.
And not everybody has a family who's putting the time into making those protections. There's lots of vulnerable people who have no family. Yeah. And that's one of the issues, is that we really need, we want to protect, like you said, it's prevention. It's not the after effect. We want to prevent this from happening.
So how do we basically encourage, force, oblige homes to be more vigilant? Is it greater penalties? Is it obliging more cameras, like having more inspections? What can the ministry level do? You know what the family levels can do, but ministry level, what could be brought to bear to make sure these cases don't happen again?
I really think it's the ministry really has to step up and do the inspection. They put in a fairly new unit who are supposed to be investigating these. I'm not aware of any cases that have actually ever been prosecuted yet, even though that unit's been around for a couple of years. And so until they really are making the homes accountable, yes, there's going to be civil suits, but they're covered by, you know, insurance and you know, as I said, not everybody can go that route. And I really think it has to be the ministry who is ultimately responsible for ensuring this is being properly prosecuted. And that's really what it needs to be done. If the homes have a pattern where they're knowing, where they're not reporting, where, you know, these things are ongoing, I really think the ministry has to do better.
All right. That'll have to be the last word. I'm sorry, we're at 1 o'clock, but I want to thank both of you so much for coming on and discussing this very distressing case. Melissa Miller of Howie Sachs and Henry LLP and Jane Mita, staff lawyer and advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly. Thank you so much. That will be our show for today. It's been a pleasure being here with all of you. Libby is back from holidays and back in the chair tomorrow, so be sure to tune in again at 12 on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.